And it's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker for this evening. He is a fellow university president at the University of Richmond, where I am especially pleased and feel a kinship with him in that he also continues to teach a course to students while serving as president of the university. He is one of the nation's leading scholars on the history of the American South. He has authored or edited more than 10 books, including The Promise of the New South, Life After Reconstruction, which was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. And it was named the best book on the history of American race relations on the history of the American South. His book, In the Presence of Mine Enemies, Civil War in the Heart of America, 1859-1963, received the Albert Beveridge Award from the National Historical Association and the 2004 Bancroft Prize. In addition to his administrative responsibilities, as I said, and I appreciate this so much, he remains active as a teacher. For his outstanding work in the classroom, he has been named the 2003 National Professor of the Year for research and doctoral universities by the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. He has also received the Outstanding Faculty Award from the State Council on Higher Education for Virginia, and he was named the recipient of the James Harvey Robinson Prize for Outstanding Aid to Teaching History by the American Historical Society. And, of course, our last panel of the afternoon focused on the importance of the teaching of history in our country. It's a real privilege to have him with us, and to be able to introduce to you Ed Ayers. Ed?
Thank you so much. It's great to see everybody. And let me say right now, I know the salads look so good and the dressing's right there. You're not going to hurt my feelings if you go ahead. Matter of fact, you'll assuage my guilt a little bit if you'll just go ahead and dig into those salads. And I want to see all that butter gone and bread by the time. So I've been so pleased and impressed to be here today. I met these wonderful young people who were sort of stuck with helping take care of me and ask as many questions as I could of my friend Lindsay Robertson, who's a professor in your law school, a former student of mine. And I want to try to live up to the excellence that was established by all the prior speakers today. I would say they didn't have salads in front of their listeners, but I do. So I'll cut myself just a little bit of slack on that. But what I want to talk about tonight is I think that here, 150 years after the Civil War, there are still mysteries. And there's two mysteries that are twinned. How was it that a war that no one intended and no one wished descended upon the largest, richest, and most successful democracy in the world? We should be perpetually surprised by the Civil War. I don't let my students refer to the phrase antebellum before the war. It's always antebellum. We just don't know when the war's coming, and they didn't either. Okay? So that's one mystery. How was there a Civil War? And two, how was it that out of this disaster of a war came the greatest blessing in American history, the end of perpetual bondage for 4 million people? To understand the Civil War, you have to deal with both of those questions. And the tendency is to say, well, the Civil War was hardwired in, that it was just a matter of time until this great nation shed the sin of slavery. But we need to remember that they'd had it for over 200 years by the time of the Civil War. We also need to remember, too, that if you told anybody in 1860 that the largest and most powerful system of slavery in the modern world is going to be gone in 5 years, nobody would have believed you. So I ask that we all bring a sense of awe and surprise to this war. It is not a single event. It is not one thing. It is not predictable at any moment in the war. So that is one of the things I want us to bring to the beginning of this talk is, okay, let's just pretend that we don't know how it turned out. You know, earlier today, we read over in a very effective speech the anatomy of Lincoln's second inaugural. And Lincoln says in that inaugural that everybody agrees that somehow slavery led to the war. From my point of view, that's the big question. What was the somehow? How was it that this happened? So we'll start with that and then figure how it was that out of that, the end of slavery came. So let's start with the first thing we need to know is that if we pull the camera way back, which is my general strategy this evening, I'm going to start before the war begins, and we're going to have a large geography in place. You can see the big red and blue monoliths of North and South and free and slavery inevitably crashing into one another. It is true that everywhere in the 19th century world, the Atlantic slavery that had grown for centuries before did come to an end. So maybe at some level, it is inevitable that the North and South would fall into armed conflict. But if we turn up the magnification a bit, we see that the patterns are not as simple as we think. So, for example, this is the election of 1852. And if those of you who are a quarter of a mile back there can't see it, yes, you're waving at me to say, yes, you can hear me, but you can't see it. Is that correct? So let me describe to you, if I could. 1852, you don't see anything that looks like the American Civil War. Okay, you see that the parties are not divided by North and South, but by parties. 1856, you're starting to see something that looks like, even in the back, you can see the red up at the top, can't you? There we go, put the glasses on, right across all the top, this new Republican Party. And I point out to people of a certain age, you look at this in 1856, if you're imagining that it's going to win the next election, that would have been like Ross Perot in 1992 winning later. Okay, that this idea that this is going to determine American history is by no means clear in 1856. But in 1860, let's see what we find. Whoa. Even here, those of you in the back can see that there are four colors there, and they're all scrambled. And it's not like the pictures in our textbooks where you have the red South and the blue North. Or people today talk about red states and blue states. We all know the complexities within each of our neighborhoods, that people aren't red and blue, but people are trying to make up their minds. This is what brings on the Civil War. It's not the inevitable conflict of a unified North and a unified South, but it's chaos. Purple, John C. Breckinridge, the strong pro-Southern candidate. Bright red, Abraham Lincoln, the strong Northern candidate. The blue in the middle, Stephen Douglas, who's trying to hold it all together. And then the yellow, the really intriguing part of the people who are really trying to call it all together, hold it all together, the Constitutional Union Party. So you have this election, and you can see that all across the South, including areas in which slavery is strongest, people are voting to say, whoa, let's slow down. Let's try to figure out how we might get out of this. And the reason you see the biggest slaveholding areas are often the people who want to compromise is because they're the ones who are going to lose something if a conflict breaks out. But down you see South Carolina, which elects, as South Carolina so often does things differently. And they see this election and they say, boy, I see a division, but what I really see is what we've been waiting for. What we've been warning you about all this time is coming to pass. A candidate has been elected in the North without the support of anybody in the South. And what this really means is we are getting out of here as quickly as we can because two bad things might happen if we wait for Abraham Lincoln to be inaugurated. One, he might do something, or two, he might not. And either way, it's going to be bad news. Because if he comes in and he seems to be the moderate man that he claims to be, we're going to let this moment of creating our own nation pass. But if we wait and he does do something, maybe that moment will pass too. So then South Carolina mobilizes all the Deep South states to secede in December and January. And they began then to make an argument to the Upper South states. They've got to persuade North Carolina and Tennessee and Virginia and Kentucky, if they can, Maryland, join us. And here are the arguments that they make. First, the South controls a virtual monopoly over the single most valuable commodity in the 19th century world. Cotton. It's the oil of the 19th century. The South has that world to itself. It is going to become, if it were its own nation, one of the most powerful nations on the face of the earth. It's already the fourth richest economy in the world. Just imagine, they said, what we could do if we were our own nation. They said, listen, this is not about agrarian versus industrial, one of the deeply ingrained things that formulas. Why do an industrial and agrarian societies need to go to war against each other? They don't. Instead, what you have is the South produces 80% of all American exports. There's no reason in the world for the North to go to war against the South for economic reasons, something you often hear. So the South says to the Upper South, come join us. What's England and France going to do? We create our own nation, they will follow us. The second thing they say is, listen, the North has elected a regional president directly opposed to our interest. What we need to do now is to make sure that we recognize that they are never going to accept us. We need to create our own nation, because what we can do then is expand, as is our destiny. We all know that we should be in Cuba here in the Confederacy. We all know that Mexico, Central America would be a great part of our alliance, because we figured out what nobody else has figured out. We figured out how to combine the machinery and progress of the cutting-edge 19th century world. They didn't say cutting-edge. That's not a phrase they would have used. The historian in me said, mark that out. Of the 19th century world with a guaranteed perpetual labor supply. We have figured out how to put the pieces together, and now we can expand. And there is a racial argument. Lincoln's election is just going to create more John Browns. It's going to create more William Lloyd Garrisons and Frederick Douglasses. With secession, however, the border will be sealed. We will be able to prevent the infiltration of our society by these Yankees who are trying to come in with their rioting, their abolitionism, to spread the contagion of black Republicans. A new Confederacy will be able to protect its own security. Then there's a religious and moral argument. Aren't you tired, fellow white Southerners, of being attacked by the North for being unchristian, when they're the ones that are transcendentalists and vegetarians and feminists and all this sort of stuff? They're the ones who aren't orthodox. We're going to be able to create, they say, the most Christian nation on the face of the earth. Because there's nowhere in the Bible that it says that slavery is wrong. It says masters, be good masters, and servants, be good servants. And we're going to show what that would look like. If we can create this Confederacy, they say, if you will join us, the South will show the world what a moral society based on slavery looks like. Now, the North argues, listen, these hot-headed secessionists aren't speaking for the whole South. Just look at all the people who voted for union. They said, all we want is that you leave things exactly as they are, that you guarantee the perpetuation of slavery. All we need is a constitutional amendment that says it will never be destroyed. We're good. That's all we need to do, that it will never be challenged. Now, the vast majority of white Northerners didn't understand that the 3/4 of white Southerners were not just being pulled by the nose, but they could be persuaded, perhaps, to join this new Confederacy. The Confederacy is going to be built around the defense of slavery, but that doesn't mean that people are just voting for their economic self-interest. It means that if they can persuade their neighbors that they are under assault from the Yankees, that the vandals from the North are coming down, they will be able to bring all white Southerners together. The vast majority of white Northerners had no desire or intention of abolishing slavery. What they did want to do was hold the slaveholders and their political power in check. They wanted to stop the expansion of slave territory, either in the United States or to Cuba. And that was the platform of the Republican Party. Now, the Republicans did present a real threat to the white South. It's not because they wanted to abolish slavery, but because they wanted to reclaim the U.S. for non-slaveholders in the North as well as in the South. Thus, white Northerners wanted two irreconcilable things: to contain the power of the slaveholding South, and to keep that slaveholding South in the Union. And these two goals would war within the North throughout the war that would come. So South Carolina gets the Deep South in, and then the attention switches to the Upper South, to Virginia. And Virginia says, we really resent South Carolina, because what you're trying to do is to drag us into a nation that you're creating. We're the mother of presidents in the United States. We are the place that created this country, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence. And you just sort of decide with whoever happens to be hanging around Columbia that you're going to secede. Well, here in Virginia, we don't do things like that. We are going to have delegates from every county in the Commonwealth. You'll see it was bigger back then. You'll recognize that. West Virginia. They're going to come to Richmond, and they're going to debate what we're going to do. We're not going to rush into this. By this time, Lincoln's been inaugurated, and Virginia thinks they're going to hold the nation together, that they're going to be the ones to save the United States, that there is still possibility of this. And so they come together and they talk for months. They talk for 3,000 pages of debating of what they're supposed to do. And so at the university, we digitized all of that. And you can do a search on it. You can see I've already done tariff, because people like to say the Civil War is caused about the Civil War. So tariff is mentioned 81 times in 3,000 pages. Let's see if slavery was mentioned. Because, you know, everybody, we heard earlier today that studies show that even young people are not persuaded that slavery is the cause of the Civil War. So slave with asterisk means it'd be slavery, slaveholder. And slave is only mentioned 1,432 times. So obviously it had nothing to do with why Virginia seceded. And what it shows is that it's a persistent theme all the way through. And they would have been surprised by later generations who said this was not about slavery. They said, well, of course it is. Why else would we be talking about what rights we have? We do have the state right to leave, we think, because our fundamental organizing institution of slavery is under threat. So what we need to do is be able to leave. Later generations scrubbed out the slavery part and just had the state's rights part. Jefferson Davis comes in and revises all that. But at the time, 1,432 times that people are saying, this is about protecting a society that is safe for slavery. So Virginia agonizes over this. While the people are debating inside, young men are burning bonfires in the streets of Richmond saying, come on, grannies, let's go, be real men, step up. Here's our chance to be the capital of this great new nation on the earth. We're going to show what the world can be. And they're so frustrated that the delegates won't do it. The great majority, the 152 delegates who came to Richmond that winter, came there to save the Union. Even though Lincoln and the Republicans said in their very platform they would not disturb slavery where it existed, that they had no constitutional right to do so, Southerners, even Unionists, said Lincoln's election is the beginning of a crusade against slavery. They called the North abolitionist, even though only about 2% of white Northerners would have identified themselves as abolitionists. They talked about the abolitionist hordes who were come down there. And so what they did is the South made the first move in bringing freedom by seceding. So the title of the lecture is Where Did Freedom Come From? It came from this. If the South doesn't secede, there's no emancipation anywhere near 1865. The South brings on the very thing that it feared in the long haul. It brings it on almost instantly, as it turns out. Because when Virginia, some of the delegates crying, votes to join the new Confederacy, and then North Carolina and Tennessee come along soon thereafter, they begin a process that Abraham Lincoln, for all his intentions, the Republican Party, for all their power, could not have begun if the white South hadn't triggered the process by walking out of the Union. And people at the time saying, hey, here in Virginia, let's guess two things. If we secede, two things could happen. One, there could be a war, and let's guess where it would be. They said the rivers of Virginia will run red with blood. Please don't do this. Please give Lincoln a chance to show what he's really going to do. We can work it out. And the other thing they said is, if we go to war, who knows what will happen to slavery. Virginia is the largest slave state in 1860. People tend to forget that. Now we're the mid-Atlantic. But back then, we were the capital of the Confederacy, right? And so they say, here we have more enslaved people, over 500,000 than anywhere else, and all this is the North. We have a big stake. So Virginia rolls the dice, hoping it's going to be able to be a part of a new nation where slavery will be safe. The other thing that the way that the white South brought the beginning of freedom is the way they talked. Because when they talked about all the Yankees being abolitionists, some people were listening. They're enslaved people. Said, oh, that's interesting. There's a whole powerful nation of abolitionists who are organizing an army. That's good to know. That's good to know. And what this means is that no matter what our masters might say, that we are going to take the risks involved in making ourselves free. So we try to picture what this might look like. And this is something we've been working on for a long time at Richmond. It's always fun to try to, let's please wait while the animation is generated. This will be a time to put more salad dressing on your salad. What you see here, and even in the back, you can see there are red dots, okay? And there are blue dots. The blue dots, and you'll start seeing it emerging as an animation, are where the United States Army is. And we've tracked where the U.S. Army is every 2 weeks in the American Civil War. Those of you who are Civil War buffs would know the official records of the War of the Rebellion, 128 volume set. We've come in and turned that into geographic information so that we can actually watch it play out. And you can see the Northern Army forming and then descending into the South. The red dots are everywhere that we can document that African Americans came into contact with the Union Army. Now, we're only up to 1862. I'll just pause for a moment. And we'll just see a few things we notice already. First of all, it doesn't take long, 1862, for the United States Army to start coming in contact with African Americans. And wherever they do, they discover some important things. They write back home in their letters and to their dispatches. Hey, Ma, I just met my first Negro. They are as smart as we are. Ma, they are as good as Christians as we are, and maybe even better. And you know what? They actually know where things are. They can tell us how to cross that river. They can tell us where this road leads. They can tell us not to listen to this white man who claims to be our friend. And you know what else they want? They want to be free. They want to be on our side. So after Virginia creates slavery for the British American context in the middle, early 17th century, within 3 weeks, a story that we heard today from Al Guzzo, within 3 weeks, they start going to Benjamin Butler and saying, we're on your side. And white Southerners, white Virginians write, for generations, we've told ourselves that they love us, that they recognize that slavery is a haven for them, a way for them to become Christian, to become civilized. And now, wherever the Yankees are, they are going to them. Have we been lying to ourselves all this time? Edmund Ruffin, who comes from Virginia down to South Carolina to fire the first shot at Fort Sumter, writes in his diaries, we can hardly believe the speed with which our servants are absconding. Slavery is dissolving before their eyes at the first moment. Abraham Lincoln has not lifted a finger against slavery at this point. Okay? This is enslaved people who are beginning the process of dissolution. The other thing they do is that Union soldiers ride home from the peninsula there in Virginia, trying to make it up to Richmond to take to the capital. The earthworks are being dug by enslaved men, Ma. We're down here from Minnesota, Vermont, on this blistering peninsula in Virginia, here in the swamps, and the Confederates are in the shade. They've got their slaves building their defenses of Richmond and all the way up the peninsula. If we don't take advantage of these two things, of joining together the possibility of these allies, who are the only friends we have down here in Virginia. You saw how many people voted for the compromise candidate in 1860? Only 1,000 white men in all of current-day Virginia fought for the United States. They changed their mind. Once Virginia decides to go with the Confederacy, they all do what Robert E. Lee says. What was I thinking? No, I'm a Confederate. And they switch over. And the Northern soldiers recognize that if they don't have the African-American people on their side, they are not going to be able to succeed in this war. So the thing is that this is not just a general desire of enslaved people to be free. These are specific acts. And each one of these acts, if you didn't have dinner waiting for you, You can click on all these, and you can see each one of these is an individual story of what happened. And you can see that the Union Army is not always a friend. You can imagine you're an 18-year-old woman with a baby on your own, and you hear the Yankees are 3 miles away. You could try to make your way to the Yankee camps, and you might find that they would take you in as a cook or to wash their clothes. Or you might find that you are raped and abused. You could go there and find that your baby would finally have enough to eat, or you might find that they would catch the diseases that ran rampant throughout the camps that grew up wherever the Union Army paused long enough for the free people to find them. So you look at all this and you see that emancipation is not an event from Washington, even though it requires that event from Washington. It's not purely a military event. It's not purely the actions of the enslaved people themselves, because they cannot take these actions if there is not an ally of the United States Army around. And you can see, even with all this activity, even the United States Army, so we're up to 1864 now, the United States Army only makes its way into contact with about 500,000 of the 4 million people held in slavery. So 3.5 million people in bondage never are within reach of the United States Army soldier. The presence of the ones that they do see filter back in to military policy, and they filter back in to politics. Because all the time that this is happening, other things are happening as well. Piling up my notes here and move them out of the way. Here's another amazing thing. If on those first days that McClellan had been able to take Richmond, in 1862, as he should have been able to have done, slavery would not have come to an end in the Civil War. So who else helps bring the end of slavery? Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. If they had allowed Richmond to fall before there had been an explicit declaration that this war was somehow about slavery, the end of slavery would not have come with the speed and finality that it did. So ironically, if the Confederates had just allowed themselves to lose early on, they wouldn't have lost nearly as much. Similarly, if there had been a presidential election in 1862 and people had voted for president the same way they voted for state and local office, Abraham Lincoln might not have been reelected. So, but there was not an election. And everybody knows that what's happening now is what's going to happen in the election of 1864. So we've seen the roles that Southern voters, the Union Army, the enslaved people, and the two armies played in making freedom. Now, Lincoln so far has appeared as something of an accompanist, even though he was the focus of most of our talks today. What role did he and the white Northern population that elected him play? Now, abolitionists and radical Republicans pressed Lincoln to act more boldly against slavery, while many Democrats swore, start to finish, that they would not fight a war on behalf of black Americans. Lincoln could never be sure that any gain that he won could long endure, or would endure even to the next election. Despite his eloquence and skill, and despite the Union's growing success on the battlefield, white public opinion in the North refused to consolidate behind Lincoln's leadership on the key issue of black Americans and their future. The war divided the white North rather than unifying them. As more and more sons and brothers and fathers died on the fields of the South, the North became even more at each other's throats. They didn't just decide, oh, now I see, this is a war to end slavery. They were trying to decide, when's enough is enough? How long is this going to go on? The Democrats smelled blood in 1864 and went on the attack. In short, his administration has cost the nation 1 million men and $3,000 million, leaving the country in a tenfold worse condition than it was on the day he assumed the chair of state, one paper spat. And it is fair to presume that 4 more years of the imbecility, corruption, and fanaticism that had prevailed during the last 3 would result in not only the complete ruin and exhaustion of the country, but in division and the total overthrow of Republican institutions. Will the people try the experiment? We trust not. By August of 1864, prominent Republicans had concluded that Lincoln would be defeated. Their only hope, many believed, was to nominate a different candidate. Nobody here doubts it, one admitted to Lincoln, nor do I see anybody from other states who authorizes this latest hope of success. Now, the Republicans did manage to submerge their differences long enough to renominate Lincoln. But to signal their central purpose to skeptical voters, they changed their name to the Union Party and nominated a former Democrat, Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, for the vice presidency. Now, Lincoln had many advantages, and he used patronage adroitly to discipline his splintered party. Voters in occupied Kentucky and Maryland and Missouri, where the Republicans had barely appeared in 1860, voted for Lincoln. So did voters in the new states of West Virginia, Nevada, and Kansas, while popular Republican parties like the Homestead Act won support for the party in the West. For the first time, too, soldiers in the field voted, and about 3/4 of the million who cast ballots voted supporting their commander-in-chief. So what happened as a result? 1864... Lincoln wins the same percentage of the northern vote that he'd won in 1860. After the Gettysburg Address, after Gettysburg, after the fall of Atlanta and the Shenandoah Valley, save the election for Lincoln, nearly half of white northern men would not vote for Abraham Lincoln in the middle of the Civil War. Now, he wins 55% of the vote. That's a landslide. 45% of white northern men not being willing to support Abraham Lincoln in the middle of that tells you that there is a profound difference of opinion and passion in the North about what's going to happen. We need to remember this as we tell ourselves a story of the redemption of the United States, of the revolution in northern opinion. Thank goodness for Abraham Lincoln, who was able to hold all this together. Nothing that I'm saying diminishes Lincoln. Matter of fact, if we understand what he's up against, we admire his skill even more. But here's the thing. We like to tell ourselves a story here on the sesquicentennial that this was the great turning point in American history. But the terror that is to follow in Reconstruction is not imaginable if you don't remember that 45% of men would not vote for Abraham Lincoln. So here's another crucial part of the story. Destroying slavery became northern policy, even though there was never a vote by the white northern population if you support that or not. Slavery came to an end not because white northerners changed their minds, but because white southerners forced slavery to be destroyed. When the war came to an end, Lincoln had laid out no plan for reconstructions. Various factions of the Republican Party argued among themselves, and the Democrats stopped the momentum of emancipation before it could go any further. When Lincoln was inaugurated for a second term in the spring of 1865, the eloquent, the best speech ever given by an American president, or maybe by any American, the second inaugural, here's the Democrats' response. This speech has been looked for by the public with less interest than is usually exhibited, even in ordinary times, in regard to a public expression from the pens or lips of a president of the United States. He has given us the mere trash to which we refer our readers as unworthy of comment. He had nothing to say, and he has said it. We have to assume that 45% of white Northerners would have agreed with that opinion of the second inaugural. Now, Frederick Douglass would write a decade after Lincoln's assassination that, viewed from genuine abolition ground, Mr. Lincoln seemed a tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. But measuring him by the sentiment of his country, a sentiment he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined. In such a context, Abraham Lincoln's leadership lay in capturing what he could from each moment of possibility, of avoiding the worst in each moment of disaster. His leadership lay in doing less than many wanted, later than many wanted, in less dramatic ways than many wanted. He worked at the very edge of public opinion, repeatedly testing its boundaries and its strength. And in the end, Lincoln led this nation through an unimaginably costly war to a redemptive outcome, ending the largest system of slavery in the modern world in a victory that many of his white northern neighbors would not have supported. We need to remember this, not to feel guilty, but to be humble and grateful that slavery came to an end when it did. This was not just modernization waiting to work its magic. This was not just the ripeness of time for America to wake up. This was history, where things happen that no one is in full control of. So where did freedom come from? It took many hands to loosen the brutally hard knots of slavery. Some of those hands loosened those ropes without meaning to. Others risked their very lives straining at them. Without the role of each of the actors, from the secessionists to the soldiers to the enslaved people to the narrow majority of Northern voters, freedom would not have come as it did. Emancipation reminds us of where all significant social change comes from. It comes from work on the ground and engagement in the political system. It comes from individuals and from institutions. It comes from power and from the apparently powerless. It comes through a purposeful action and through accident. It comes from a minority of determined people seizing a moment of possibility. This is why history is more than the sum of its parts. It is about things connecting, often in unpredictable ways. It's a complex braiding of time and space, of ideology and personality and partisan politics and military exigency and simple good fortune. And we need to remember this. We all live in history all the time. This is what we are living in as well. There is greater possibility for positive things than we can imagine. If they can imagine the end of slavery, what could we imagine? But things much worse than we can imagine, if we're complacent, can also happen. What we need to do is pay attention and recognize that all the parts of the society matter, that everybody can help make history, including us. Thank you all so very much for having me. Sure. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
A couple of questions.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed Ayers, and he's agreed to take. We'll just take a couple of questions.
A couple of easy questions.
I know this is a hungry audience. So,
I see one in
the
middle.
Yes, back here, or here.
What percentage of people in the South actually owned slaves, and how did they convince those non-slave owners?
Yep, that's a great question.
That's what I've never understood.
Yep. Well, I'm going to explain it to you right now. The question was, what percentage of white Southerners owned slaves, and how did they persuade those who did not to fight? 25% own at least one slave, okay? And so, of families. That's actually fairly broadly distributed. But what that means is that, and this is Lincoln's calculation, why would the 3/4 of white Southerners don't own slaves follow these crackpots into violating their loyalty to the United States, a United States that allowed this society to flourish? Most of the presidents have been slaveholders. The Supreme Court has been friendly to slaveholders. What are they complaining about? They want everything, is actually the energy driving the Republican Party. It's the arrogance of the white South. So they could not persuade them, you see, to necessarily vote in the abstract. But this is why you need to understand that each moment is framed in a different way. It's different when Abraham Lincoln's elected than it was the day before. Then it's different when you see South Carolina seceding, who says, hey, guess what? We've just cut, now we brought in all the Deep South states. Let's think what Congress looks like for you. Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee. We've abandoned you to the North. Thank us very much, and come join us. And then as soon as you think about the North coming to occupy the federal territories, then suddenly, doesn't matter what you believe about slavery, now your state, your homeland is being invaded. And so people say, well, why did they fight? Every white man who was able-bodied fought. You were conscripted if you didn't. It's not like you, do I really want to fight this war? That was not the question. Once your state secedes, then the machinery comes of persuasion, and then of force. So I think people have a misconception. It's like the old movie Shenandoah with Jimmy Stewart, in which he has these seven strapping young men who think they'll just set out the war. You're not going to do that. It becomes a total mobilization. So at different points in all this, there's different answers of why somebody would fight. The quickest way I've been able to think to crystallize what I just said is that the Civil War is an unbalanced equation. The North does not go to war to end slavery, because you could not.
By anything that they knew in 1861, the prospect of waging a war to end slavery couldn't have happened. But the South does go to war to protect it. So you have to have these two things that are, both of them are true, but they don't line up at a straight angle. That's kind of a long answer, but we still have one more question, right?
One more question.
All right. Who else? If anybody in the far back? You guys paid the dues. You want to have a chance? I'm really not just 18 inches tall. As you'll see later, I'm a normal-sized person. Nope. All right.
I think there's someone here. Is that it? Any other questions?
Yes. This is a question.
Question right there.
Yes, sir.
I read recently that the guard assigned to look after Lincoln at the Ford Theater took off and had a few drinks and got a snoot full, I guess, and collapsed. And what I wanted to know is, was there any investigation as to whether this was some kind of a conspiracy or somebody added to the fact that the guard was there, and if the facts are correct, he would have saved Lincoln from being assassinated?
Yeah, I think that the story, this is a joke from earlier today, I think he's an Enid, is what I hear, is that the guard snuck off. Yeah, I mean, everybody at this moment of the assassination, everybody was suspicious of everybody else. So they look into all of those things. So I think that could Lincoln's assassination have been prevented that night? Yes, I think it could. Do I think that there were people who were out to kill Lincoln and could have found some other opportunity? Yes, I think they could have. I think I feel
honor bound. One last question.
Okay. This better be easy.
We're rolling into the centennial of what we call the First World War. And we had Jay Winter here a couple of weeks ago comparing the memory of the war we've been talking about today with that other one, a modern,
right.
Arguably they're both the first modern war. And what he drew this very striking question that it's very important for the modern memory of the First World War to see it as this meaningless meat grinder in literature and philosophy and
right.
poetry and so on. Whereas for his colleague, David Blight, who came up today,
yep.
it's very important for people, the revisionists, to say this is a meaningful war. It is about something. It is about freedom. It is about the ending of slavery. It is not just a pointless meat grinder, a mad elephant riding off in all directions. Can you comment on that, please?
I can't comment. I would hope that nothing I said suggested that there was anything meaningless about this, okay? It was filled with meaning. Everybody was fighting for a reason. Everybody thought that they were doing something entirely logical that made all the sense in the world at each moment. And this idea that it's like Gone with the Wind, where all these young boys are surround Scarlet and they're just going to go off just because it seems like a good fling, it's not true. People on all sides, black and white, knew what they were doing. Everybody had a script for what this means. The thing is that you add up the pieces. I do think this is the way that the Great War is the same way, is that it's not a thing. There's no such thing as the Civil War until it's over. It's always just the next battle. Things are going to pivot. Things are going to turn. And deep into 1864, the White South thinks things are going to turn. So I think the same thing's true for the Great War. We need to dissolve our sense of this ends up in the chaos of the early 20th century and modernism and all this comes out of it. People at the time, each step along the way, knew exactly what they were doing. It's just that it adds up to a totality that's nothing like what anybody wanted. So the point of all this is that these are braids that make sense. We can pull them apart. You can see how each one of them made sense. But that doesn't mean that we can predict how history is going to turn out. There's a kind of awe, as I want to end with, of understanding the complexity of how these different patterns fit together. It's a puzzle that you have to take apart before you can put it back together. And I appreciate your generous time and energy tonight. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Ed Ayers.